2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 321, Interview, Mormonism and Science, Issues for the Coming Century. Participants, Dwayne E. Jeffrey and Keith E. Norman.
Morning, everyone. This session today is entitled Mormonism and Science Issues, Mormonism and Science, Issues for the Coming Century, an interview with Dwayne Jeffrey. Dwayne Jeffrey is a professor of zoology at BYU. He has published numerous articles on genetics, evolution, and LDS history and doctrine. Is this on? Oh, okay. I'm accustomed to it being too loud. He is also a member of, American Association for the Advancement of Science, Society for the Study of Evolution, and the Genetic Society of America. He has been awarded the Professor of the Year at BYU and the Carl G. Mazur Teaching Award. Thank you. Today, Dwayne will be interviewed by Keith Norman. Keith is the Human Resources Management for, is that HUI Industries?
HMI.
HMI Industries of Cleveland, Ohio. Buddy's noted that that's irrelevant. and to not include it in the program. Sorry about that. Okay. He has a PhD from Duke University in Early Christian Studies and an MTS from Harvard Divinity School in Church History and New Testament, and was a graduate with a BA in history from BYU. So, without any further ado, we'll get started with this and allow Norman to ask his questions of Dwayne. And if there's time for questions from the audience at the end, what we'll do is I'll just put that mic down on the center floor. And would you please just come up to the mic rather than asking your question from the seats, come up to the mic so that it can be recorded on the tape for this session. Thank you very much.
Well, it's such a privilege to be here today and talk to Dwayne. When we were coming in, Dwayne said he was a little intimidated by the size of this room and all the people here. I think Dwayne needs to realize that he's a hero of an awful lot of people in this gathering for what he's done and written. And I want to start off asking you, Dwayne, about how you got started in science as a career, and what kind of issues did you face in terms of reconciling some of the conflicts that I think inevitably come up between your religious upbringing and beliefs and the scientific career as it developed?
Well, I was raised really in a rather anti-scientific environment. A little farming community where we had all the answers because nobody was asking very many questions. And it was only when I got to university, really, at Utah State University, that I began encountering a number of problems. I was majoring in just about everything for the first couple of years. But on my mission, I had some experiences with what we might call doctrinal dissident groups or offshoot groups from Mormonism, and for the first time in my life I began to see that even inside Mormonism there were different ways of looking at Scripture. On returning to college, I had decided to major in biology, and that threw me instantly with a number of students who were very strong for science and very anti-religion, as well as many such as myself who were rather the other way, but I was also called on a stake mission at that point, and for some reason it seemed that all the so-called problem cases were dumped on me. I ended up working still with members of various dissident groups. The Church of the Firstborn of the Fullness of Times was a big one in those years and was making tremendous headway in the church. And we didn't have very much doctrinally in those early years to do much with it. So I was working not only with a number of missionary contacts who were in science and interested in such things as evolution and materialist philosophies and so on, but trying to find what was going on in religion. So between all of that mix, it was a very heady time, and I spent far more time studying my religion than I did studying my science, which has not been to the benefit of my career in many ways. I was impressed with the director of the Institute of Utah State, Wendell Rich, who was just in the process of finishing his book, Distinctive Teachings of the Restoration, trying to look at ways of knowing and how Mormonism interacted with such things. I was very impressed with Eldon Gardner, who was probably one of Utah's premier scientists and also a very active and committed member of the church. So they were critical in in helping me in those early years. I encountered a book, just a book of fiction, called Dorian, written by Nephi Anderson, one of the books written back in the 20s and 30s by Nephi, trying to teach principles, moral principles, to LDS youth. And this one was one that really dealt with science and religion, but quoting extensively from a book called Natural Law in the Spiritual World. And I was impressed with those quotes. This was by a guy by the name of Henry Drummond, but this was in a novel, and I really thought that Henry Drummond and the book Natural Law in the Spiritual World were really nothing more than literary devices being used by Anderson to try to get across his message in this book called Dorian, which dealt with science, religion, Mormonism, and so on. And I remember visiting a farmer in Malad, Idaho, for some reason in those years, and sitting on his bookshelf was Natural Law in the Spiritual World by Henry Drummond. It was really a spiritual experience for me, because his argument was that the natural laws that we see here are just extensions of the laws that exist through the universe. That resonated greatly with the Mormonism that I had been taught. evolution was a problem with that, but I quickly borrowed the book and devoured it. It clearly was well out of date. And then I began finding in Mormon history, where at the turn of the century, that had been a very, very popular book in Mormonism. It was one of the alternate books, for instance, for the use with B.H. Roberts' 70s course in theology from 1907 to 1912. John Henry Evans, the apostle, in his biography of Joseph Smith, indicates that Henry Drummond had these marvelous ideas of how God uses the natural laws that we know to operate the whole universe, that we see just the lower end of those same laws. And he said Henry Drummond made this popular, but he was 50 years behind Joseph Smith in coming to those concepts. So those were very heady concepts for me. And I had gone through a master's degree in ecology, wildlife ecology, but it became evident to me that evolution was rather a critical area that I needed to study further. It seemed to me there were two major ways to evaluate it. One was by paleontology and fossils, but I thought that those were primarily interpretational. That you find a fossil, but then you have to try to interpret what it means. I was relatively naive. You can do much more than that. But it seemed to me that what was critical and testable was the process, and that was genetics. So I then shifted gears in my career and started on doctor work in genetics and trying to see what could be found about the mechanisms of evolution. That's been an interesting study ever since, and that was a long introductory statement, but maybe I'll turn it back to you at this point.
Well, I want to talk about a little bit about how you've ended up at BYU and how that experience has been. BYU has a renowned paleontology collection. It's a paradoxical place, I think. It has this great paleontology collection, all these dinosaur bones, which were used to be under the stadium somewhere, I guess.
Many still are.
Many still are. And I'm told that the zoology department is rated as the top graduate school on campus. And this is a campus where the religion department has, it is on kind of one end of the spectrum towards literalism in interpretation of the scriptures. And I guess the religion department is there still a religion department? Did I hear they were doing away with
College,
that?
College of Religion.
College of Religion,
College
okay.
of Religion Instruction.
Okay, well, they have been traditionally very opposed to organic evolution, the scientific evolution. And so you have this conflict, I think, on campus, and you go to one class and hear one thing and go to another class and hear the opposite thing. To me, this is a very intriguing paradox that the campus has. How free do you feel like the discussion is on these kinds of topics on the campus? And how do you deal with students who are troubled by the conflicts they see?
Well, that covers a lot of territory. I came to BYU because just toward the end of my doctoral work, I was called into the telephone in the lab one day, and this voice introduced himself as the head of the zoology department at BYU, and he said, "We would like to offer you a job." And I said, "You don't know anything about me." And he said, "Well, aren't you just finishing your degree with Kurt Stern, who was well-renowned?" And I said, "Well, yes, that's true." And aren't you counselor in the bishopric there in the university ward? And I said, "Well, yes, that's true." And he says, "Well, I think we've done our homework. We'd like to offer you a job." This absolutely blew my mind. And I will guarantee you, we don't hire people that way at BYU anymore. It turned out they'd had an accreditation visit. It was made very clear that they needed a geneticist. They didn't have one. They could find two LDS geneticists in the country, and they knew they didn't want the other guys. So I got there by default. And we had been there but a relatively short time, a couple of years, when Dallin Oaks became president of BYU. And one of his first activities was to organize a seminar between selected faculty members in science on campus and what was supposed to have been all the College of Religion faculty. This was an ongoing seminar. Many of those people did not participate, I should indicate. You've indicated there may have been some animosity. One of them did write a 7-page letter to his dean and told them that he would never participate in such a satanic enterprise as to meet with the scientists on campus. And he never did show up. But we had a wonderful series of seminars that established some very good rapport between the college faculties at that time.
This would have been when?
This was the early 1970s, right. Probably around 74, 75. And that went on for, a year and a half, 2 years, I don't remember. Somewhere back in my notes, I've got the notes of that seminar. But it was a wonderful discussion between the groups, and did a lot to try to bring common understanding. There were still those who felt that science was satanic. Most of them never attended. Well, I think none of them attended the seminars. Even though one was on the steering committee and that sort of thing, he would never come to the formal meetings. But however that may be, we established a very good rapport. Now, a number of those individuals, most of those individuals, have since retired and have been replaced in general with individuals who are not quite so threatened by science, I think, in their lives. There are a number there in the College of Religion that I think are quite open to many ideas of science and who have the feeling that God can reveal things through sources other than just through strict ecclesiastical sources. That has helped. Now, if you ask about the paleontology at BYU, we did have, many years ago, a chap by the name of James Jensen who loved to collect dinosaur fossils and who pioneered many of the techniques to suspend those fossils with internal structures. The old way was to put up a big structure with rebar and everything hanging around it so you could barely see a dinosaur fossil, for instance. Jim was a pioneer in doing the internal structure. And for those of you who haven't been down to the new North American Museum of Ancient Life down at Thanksgiving Point, I would strongly recommend you go. They've just opened up about 3 weeks, a month ago, with their new section, and it is marvelous. It's being billed as the largest dinosaur museum anywhere on the planet. I don't know for sure that's true, but I don't know who's going to beat it. But you'll see this internal suspension that Jim Jensen pioneered, and you just see the animals standing there, bigger than this room, a couple of them. And that really is worth the price of admission down there. Well, however that may be, Jim was doing a lot of collecting, and the only place we had to store things was under the stadium, as you indicated. We do have the small dinosaur museum on campus, and people are continuing to work with that. There have been people at BYU who have recognized the strength and power of having that, and others who have been, I think, uncomfortable with it. There was a movement several years ago to try to get rid of it, and it very nearly succeeded. But let me share, if I may, a little anecdote that goes along with that. Wade Miller at that time, a chap who specializes really in mammal evolution from relatively recent periods, Pleistocene and so on, was the director of the museum and was invited to go to Italy by CES, the Church Education System, and give a seminar to the LDS youth in Italy on science and religion. Wade came back from that seminar and came into my office almost unable to speak, telling me that he was still overwhelmed emotionally with the not only the deference and the reverence and the respect, but almost the sense of worship, of awe, with which he was treated by the young people from Italy. Now, it wasn't just Italy. Word had got out, and so there were young people there from Italy and France and Austria and Switzerland and Spain and Portugal. There were six or seven nations that had young people there just to hear a Mormon scientist. Wade said it was beyond their comprehension that you could be an active Latter-day Saint and be a scientist. And he said they would stand there almost, he said it was reverential. He was embarrassed with the whole way they were treating him.
Were these primarily Mormon students?
Well, these are Mormon students.
Okay.
These are Mormon students. And But beyond that, Wade was invited to be on national Italian television. He's been back once since. Again, has been on national television. They have made a big point out of the fact that how can a religious institution be studying dinosaurs and fossils? And Wade has had a wonderful opportunity. National television? How do you buy that kind of coverage? But yet we downplay the whole connection between science, religion, gospel here. I had an opportunity a few years ago to talk to one of the CES directors in England and in Europe and asked him about this situation of our young people, science, religion, and a church. And he said, let's be very clear. Our young people face two choices. They grow up, they go on their mission, they come home, then they make a choice. Do they go to university or do they stay with the church? Those are seen as mutually exclusive categories. The European, and particularly the Italian universities, he said, are aggressively atheistic. And anyone who goes to university doesn't usually survive it in terms of staying with the church. So he said, yes, we lose them right and left. We're losing many in this country. And I find myself wondering, with that dichotomy, which seems to me to be relatively unnecessary. Sure, we can find a lot of problems. There really are. But I think we ought to be addressing those problems. And when we're getting that kind of positive publicity, for instance, in Italy, national television and so on, it seems to me that we're missing a good bet by not doing a little more with that paleontology collection at BYU and doing well with our other programs. Now, you referred to the fact that maybe zoology has been well-rated recently in graduate school programs. That is true. We came out fairly well. Chemistry is also a very, very powerful department. I think our evolutionary biology team at BYU probably does lead in terms of the non-LDS students who are coming to BYU to get degrees in evolutionary biology, the postdocs from other institutions and other countries. We have them strung all the way from, throughout Latin America, South Africa, European countries, Egypt, that have been coming for evolutionary biology programs. And these are visiting professors on sabbaticals, as well as postdocs, as well as people coming for PhD degrees. So it has become a very strong program. And our dean recently made the comment, he said, it might seem a little strange that the evolutionary biology program at BYU would be one of our better, but we need to let that be known. We have people of faith who are working with that. We need to let that be better known. So I have hopes maybe that will happen, but I don't know. How free is the discussion at BYU? You raised that point. I wouldn't want to say that we have open discussion of these topics on campus. It still does get to be a science versus religion thing for too many people. This got pushed to a head in 1992. President Rex Lee called me one day and said, look, I'm just getting tired of people asking questions about what's the church's position on evolution. So he said, will you put the first presidency statements in the library? I'm having an open forum in a couple of weeks where he just responded to questions from students. And he said, I want to have a student ask me about evolution and the gospel, so I can tell him to go right to the library and find a packet of materials so I don't have to keep answering the question. Well, I thought that was a smart idea from Rex. And so we put in a whole collection of things from presidents of the church and from First Presidency, feeling that only they really could speak, you know, authoritatively for the church. There were people on campus who felt that that was stacking the deck, to just look at First Presidency and presidents of the church, and who had their other favorite authorities that they wanted to put in there as well. So out of that came a small committee that was appointed to try to put together what are the critical documents that then was presented to our Board of Trustees in summer of 92. That included the First Presidency at that point and seven members of the Quorum of the Twelve, along with a few other people who sit on that board. And they approved this official packet of materials that represent the official position of the church on evolution. For those of you who know the literature, there's the cover letter that says that only formal statements from the First Presidency should be considered doctrinal, that God has told why man was created but never said how, that hopefully these things will help people study the gospel in an atmosphere of faith. And then it includes the November 1909 statement from Joseph F. Smith. It includes a little excerpt from his December 1910 Christmas message that says, that which is demonstrated we accept with joy, but wild ideas and so on we don't, unless they've got some validation. It includes the 1925 statement that was given during the Scopes trial up in Tennessee, which took out all the anti-evolutionary material from the 1909 one. And then it includes the excerpt from the 1992 Encyclopedia of Mormonism, the little article there on evolution, into which the First Presidency had considerable input. So those are included. Now, I usually include with that the April 1910 statement where the First Presidency, Joseph F. Smith, etc., give you three options for the origin of all the human beings. Divinely directed evolution through natural processes, transplantation from another sphere, or born here in mortality as other mortals have been, but they say the scriptures don't resolve it beyond here. I've always found it interesting that they do not include the literal reading of scripture in those three options. Now, that constitutes the last and most specific statement from the First Presidency on a subject, and that has helped greatly reduce a lot of the animosity that was there previously, because both everyone on campus was asked whenever they addressed the subject of evolution, particularly the origin of humans, that they distribute this packet and make that available to students, and that has been very useful. But so we do not have an open discussion on the topic, no.
But it sounds like the situation at BYU is a little less polarized than at least I had thought. But in the church, My perception, at least, is that the tendency has been more towards a creationist view of interpreting the scriptures, which seems a little strange to me, given the materialist theology that Mormonism has. God has a physical body, and creation really means organizing pre-existing matter. And in that sense, shouldn't Mormonism be particularly unthreatened by organic evolution? And I'm really concerned that we are losing the best and brightest of the generation coming up. You talked about the students in Italy and Europe who are thirsting for that kind of thing, and it's so rare for them to get that. My oldest son started his college career at Case Western Reserve University, which is probably the premier scientific technical school in Ohio. And he was, at the time, kind of chafing at his church involvement. And I unwisely told him that I would give him financial support if he went to institute. And, you know, whenever we exercise control or dominion or compulsion over the souls of the children of men, that's not the way to go. Well, anyway, the institute teacher was talking about the scriptural account of creation in very narrow terms. And the question was raised in the class, well, what about the dinosaurs? And he said, oh, that's a good question. You know, I've thought a lot about that, and I think I have come up with something that really resolves that quite neatly. Of course, the class leaned forward. They were all eager to hear it. You remember, these are sophisticated science students. And he said, you see, the dinosaurs couldn't fit on the ark.
Well, that handles it. There you go.
That's what the teacher thought. The class sat in stunned silence. My son, said they were incredulous, but apparently the teacher interpreted that as having solved the issue. So he went on. Went on with his lesson plan. Sometimes when you ask for a bread, you get a stone.
Ask for fish, you get a snake. Yes, a serpent.
Well, so when my son recounted this to me, he said, Dad, I don't think this institute is having quite the effect you planned on me. So how do we salvage this upcoming generation of students when, as both scholars and faithful members of the church, when their encounters with the official church border on stubborn irrationalism or even downright silliness?
Well, you ask a difficult question, of course, and that's why you bring it up. We've been having I think probably as a classic example of that would be the current lesson manual on Joseph F. Smith. Many here will have undoubtedly run into lesson number 37, which has to do with, we're the sons and daughters of God. It builds its entire presentation around the November 1909 First Presidency Statement on the origin of man. But it totally ignores everything else that happened in the Joseph F. Smith administration. I talked with a friend of mine who's a member of that writing committee and said, you put us in a real bind. We have to, first of all, in the sciences, try to reconcile gospel with what students see in the sciences. But now you put us in a position where we have to reconcile Joseph F. Smith with the present church. That gets to be even more difficult. And we have to try to defend you as a writing committee when it is obvious to our students that you have not been honest with the Joseph F. Smith materials. He said, oh my, I'm just afraid we didn't bring ourselves up to speed on Joseph F. Smith and science. And I had to say, well, yes, I think that's a nice statement, but what will we do about it in the future? I had heard rumors that the next manual would be John Taylor. And I've had great concerns that they might use a passage from John Taylor wherein he says that new species cannot be generated. And I pointed out to my friend that, we've been making species since about 1926 or 27. That exact same statement, and this always gets taken out of there, is that President Taylor said that chemical elements cannot change from one to another. And I said, you know, you don't go to Hiroshima and tell people that, you know, that the atom can't be split and make new kinds of atoms, because it jolly well can. President Taylor was trying to say that there are eternal laws that do not change. And unfortunately, he picked a couple of bad examples. But if you're going to use that, please, I mean, if you're going to do it on John Taylor, please don't put in those passages, because you're just going to complicate further the credibility of both the writing committee and a prophet of the church. And I don't think we need to get into that. He said, well, the manual is not going to be on John Taylor. He wouldn't tell me what it was going to be. Trying to keep that very, very quiet so people don't write all sorts of manuals about how to explain what so-and-so said. And I can understand that. So I'm sympathetic with that, and I don't know what the manual will be. But I just hope it doesn't do more of that. But it does put us in a real bind. And one thing I have learned over the years is one, how extremely fragile religious faith can be for many people, and how absolutely firecracker volatile it can be for others. And sometimes it's the tiniest little thing that will trigger people. I had a student come to me one day. He said, I went to a fireside you gave 3 months ago, and I've finally got on evolution and Mormonism, and I finally got back to the point I can pray again. And I said, well, what was your problem? And he said, well, you read that letter from Daniel McKay that said the church had no official position on evolution. I could not imagine a prophet of God ever saying that. And I haven't been able to pray since over that statement. And I thought, how unbelievably fragile. You know, I wonder what's gone on in this young man's background to make it quite that way. But he's not alone, and I've certainly seen many others since. So how do we work with students at BYU? We try to work on them in classes, sensitively, openly, honestly. Try to make clear to them at first, the one thing I will not do is lie to you if I can possibly help it. If there's a topic of controversy here, I want to make sure that you know everything that's been said on the issue. And I don't have any problem with that, because that means there's not really a position around. It's the ones that say there is a position that have to start selecting and choosing their sources. Then we spend a lot of time just in the office talking with people individually and trying to help them through some of these questions. There has been a drift in the church toward creationism, and creationism itself, as it is generally used in American society, is completely incompatible with basic Mormon theology. We won't take time here to explore that, but it is just incompatible. People seem to think that, well, I believe in creation, so therefore I'm a creationist. And I like to point out that you live in a democracy. Does that make you a Democrat? We live in a republic. Does that make you a Republican? You're clearly an adult. Does that make you an adulterer? And believe me, you can believe in creation without being a creationist. That is a very, very precise theological position that is absolutely incompatible with Mormonism. Since you mentioned dinosaurs on the ark, let me deal a little bit.
Not on the ark. They didn't make it on the ark.
I'm sorry, and they can't swim either. They can't tread water. Did you ever hear that Bill Cosby tape about Adam?
Yes.
And God saying to Adam, how long can you tread water?
That's Noah.
Noah, I'm sorry. Thank you. Got the wrong patriarch here. The creationists have had a lot of problems on what to do with the ark, and have pointed out that it said that, you know, nothing survived other than what was on the ark, but they try to make exceptions for that what was in the water, not recognizing that if you have all the strata, all the material that makes up present strata, which is what they argue, up in the water, that you've really got a muddy soup in which virtually no fish and no sea life could live. So there are various games they play, but the one I like best is a recent publication, a Noah's Ark, a feasibility study by a John Widmorappy, and he's done some interesting things that I think may be of interest to the group here. It's ballyhooed as being, you know, answering all the objections about Noah's Ark without invoking any supernatural things at all. Well, that's wonderful. That's the preface. But as you read the book, you realize that every other page he's invoking supernatural, this, that, and the other. But I did like what he's done with dinosaurs. Some other people have suggested that dinosaurs did indeed survive the flood, that they were taken on the ark, that they were taken on as little babies, and therefore you had to have, you know, the clean and the unclean animals. You had to have a few of the cleans to feed the dinosaurs and so on. And so they've played around with that and have insisted that that the legends of dragons means that dinosaurs did survive from the ark, and that's where the whole idea of dragons come from, that post-Noachian people saw dinosaurs, some of which may even have breathed fire. That's perfectly acceptable. And have given rise to the legends of dragons. But I like Widmorappy's one little thing that he does. He's had to totally give up on the creationist position that there can be no new species. He thinks that he can put about 8,000 different kinds of organisms on the ark. Kinds. And get those off the ark, then have God miraculously speed up the mutation rate and generate new species. So that in the 4,500 years since the Bible gives us the date of the flood, 2344 BC, it's pretty easily calculated, so that in that period of time, we've generated all the several million species that are on the planet today from those 8,000 founders. And then God slowed it all down again to look like what we have today. This is the book that is not proposing any supernatural events, but the dinosaurs got lost in the scramble. I guess the knights killed them all off or something. He never quite deals with that, but at least that's the latest position from young Earth creationism. Excuse me.
I'm interested in how you stayed out of trouble or stayed at BYU at all. I work with the Dialogue editorial board, and we've been talking about maybe putting out an issue with the 10 or 12 most important articles of all time published in Dialogue. And almost invariably at the top of everybody's list is Sears of Ants and Evolution, which was, what, about 1975?
74.
One of the most important things that Dialogue's ever published. And I think Devery Anderson talks about this in his History of Dialogue, that when Ezra Taft Benson, who I don't know if he was president of the Quorum of the Twelve at the time, but whatever his position at the time, he heard about this. He was flabbergasted that a wacko such as yourself could be on the BYU faculty and publish something like this. What kind of flack did you experience, and how have you dealt with that?
Well, that's a long history, too. Could we just say fancy footwork? President Benson did get disturbed with my presence there. He did get disturbed over that paper, Sears and Savants and Evolution. It did turn out that he'd never read it. But he had been told about it by some ambitious underlings in the church who will remain unnamed. Gary Bergera and Ron Prittis, in their book, A House of Faith, do have a chapter on evolution at BYU, and they go into a good deal of what went on here. There were attempts to make it so I was no longer receiving a check from BYU, but President Oakes pretty well headed that off with the help of President Hinckley. There have been other episodes since. There probably best left undeveloped, I guess. I have had the support of a good many friends and other faculty members at BYU and certain administrators who have felt that the kinds of things we've been doing have been positive, have been absolutely necessary. Some of them themselves have had young members of their family who have had much the same experience that your son has had. And so they have recognized that there has to be the ability to address these issues. I should perhaps relate that in 1970 and 71, well, when I came to BYU in my interview with BYU, BYU's vice president and so on, I indicated that BYU did not have a very good reputation in biology among the universities of the nation. Even one of my good friends up at Utah State, biology professor there, who subsequently became a mission president, state mission president then, said, we get a student from BYU, he said, the first thing we're going to do is throw them into the evolution class so they can learn what biology is all about. He said, all they've got is just a mishmash. He says, they have ideas about biology that are no more organized than the confetti at a New Year's party, and we've got to help them get some sort of organization to what they've got in their head. So I mentioned this to the vice president of BYU, and I said, you know, why don't you have a class in evolution? And he said, well, because nobody's ever proposed it. Well, I happen to know that that was not an accurate reflection of history, but we took it for that. It was, you know, he was recruiting. So I said, well, if I were to come here, we'd probably be suggesting one. And he said, well, how would it be considered? And he said, the same as any other course. So Dr. Clayton White and I proposed such a course. All new courses at BYU have to be approved by the Board of Trustees. And we'll shorten that story down. But in the end, the word came back to us from Harold B. Lee, who was at that time, you know, the powerful person in the up in the church hierarchy. And he said, clearly this course is needed in the curriculum of BYU. This would be an undergraduate course in evolutionary biology. Tell those brethren to teach the most demanding and rigorous and honest course of which they are capable. Just don't go down any bandwagon and beat the church with it. Now, we knew by that time the material that later went into the paper, Sears and Savants, that came about 3 years later. And so we said, well, we don't see any need to be beating the church with it, and we don't intend to do that. That we have taught that course steadily ever since 1971, and I see one member here in the audience who was a member of that first class. So far as I am aware, we've had two complaints from students to the faculty, to the administration. Both of those have been from students who were rather interested in cultivating a relationship with people upstairs and thought this was a good way to do it. One of them wrote to our president and said, my grandfather and I have done a pamphlet that clearly sets this whole story straight, and we'd be happy to meet with you after you have chastised these faculty members here and show you how God really did things. And our president was not particularly interested in being so instructed, and so that rather died there. But I know of only those two. Now, we have had some individual faculty members who... one of whom is a former mission president, who gets very outspoken pro-evolutionarily, and BYU's vice presidents have told me they can tell precisely where he is in the introductory biology class just by the letters they get from parents. But so far as I know from the evolution class, we've only had two, and... our college just this last Tuesday morning, it was announced to all of our faculty how we were going to be completely reorganizing the 6 departments in our College of Biological and Agricultural Sciences. But along with that, the committee had developed a college core of courses. And I was gratified to see that the courses that will be required of all college majors, that's agriculture, microbiology, you know, et cetera, that college core included the evolution class. So that will now be required of all the college majors. It has been of all our department majors.
Okay, well, our time is fleeing rapidly before we quit, and I certainly want to leave time for questions from the audience, but I want to talk a little bit about this book, Evolution in Mormonism, by Trent Stevens and Jeff Meldrum, who I guess were two of your former students,
yes,
now
sir.
At Idaho State University.
They're both here this morning.
Oh,
you
great.
Want to stand up?
Yeah, please. Great.
Thank you.
Well, I really enjoyed this book. Dwayne wrote the preface to it, and I guess you can say he's the grandfather of it or something like that.
The fossil.
Well, it really piles on the physical evidence supporting organic evolution, including the deluge of data in biogenetics and the array of new fossil discoveries, which really puts to rest the idea of a missing link, as far as I can tell. I mean, that was a big deal when I was growing up, but I guess that's just no longer a factor, talking about a missing link. What kind of response has this gotten, positive or negative, to your knowledge?
This afternoon, starting at 4:15, we'll have about an hour and a half looking at that book with a
okay.
panel of people and others, and Trent and Jeff will be there. They can probably answer that question far better than I. I'm aware of many positive responses. I'm aware of a couple negative. I see one young entrepreneur has read the book in the last 10 days, as I'm trying to sell a pamphlet here at the meetings, refuting that book. So it's clearly been seen as significant enough to need response. Not from any official sources. Trent and Jeff were very, very careful to work through their stake president and have this project carried all the way to the first presidency. So I don't expect any sort of negative thing from the official sources at all. I hope it would be seen positively, because I think it is a rather positive book. I had one person that's very familiar with many books, for instance, from Signature Press, and he said, in all honesty, that's probably the most faith-promoting book that Signature publishes, which I found rather interesting, considering the fact that they published Wilford Woodruff journals and, you know, biography of Richard Blossom and all this sort of thing. So I certainly know of many, many positive, good things about the book, and only a couple of negative.
Okay, great. Well, there are several other questions I'd like to ask, but let's turn it over to the audience. Yes.
Yes, the question was that since the title talks about, you know, challenges for Mormonism in the coming century, and all we've done is stir up fossils, what about the coming century? Well, there will be more from the fossils, I'm pretty sure of that. The fossil record is getting more and more complete every day, and many people think that fossils, as I did, think that, you know, fossils are just something you find out there, but you just have to kind of speculate and interpret. And it's not that way at all. There's a tremendous amount of data that can be pulled in paleontologically about past climates and so on, which will challenge many of the concepts that many of our people have traditionally taught and believed. But I see such things as the human cloning controversy, the stem cells, debates over resource management and human populations, continuing brain research, and our incredible and still expanding, still infantile, but incredible already, ability to localize specific behavioral traits to precise areas in the brain, to relate them to specific genes. This rather flies in the face of the concepts that I was taught originally, that your body is just kind of here. It's like your house. You come live in it, but your personality is totally that of the spirit. Your body is molded to look as it does by the spirit. Your personality is that of the spirit, and so on. And clearly we're running into great difficulty as we do more with studies of, for instance, mental illness of all sorts, ways to treat mental illness. Our best ways for that, for many of them, have certainly been either surgically or with intervention with drug therapy. Those are all materialistic ways of looking at things that I think will offer considerable challenges as to how we look at what really is a human being and what really is humanness.
Come up to the mic, please.
I
question had to do, how do we live with the morality of science, particularly with the manipulation of DNA?
No, excuse me, sir. I suggest there is no morality.
All right. Scientists will argue that science is amoral. There will be those who argue that it's immoral. Those are two different things. Historically, scientists have said that they're in the business of generating knowledge, not of determining how that knowledge shall be put to use, and that they therefore try to wash their hands of any immoral uses of their knowledge. That kind of naivete got forever shattered August 6th of 1945 when the bomb blew over Hiroshima. Many scientists have struggled with that ever since and were caught. Knowledge always has two sides to it. It can be used, it can be abused. In the manipulation of DNA, we're going to be able to do some wonderful, wonderful things to better the quality of the human race. We are unquestionably opening up the potential for deep abuse. Now, scientists themselves, very frankly, do not have either the background, the training, the expertise, the interest to really engage very meaningfully in what regulations we ought to put on those kind of things. They will argue, as they're doing with stem cells, that you are consigning to death many people if you do not permit us to do stem cell research. The answer, of course, is yes, and you're killing embryos in the process. President Bush, 2 days ago, tried to take, you know, the middle course and say, well, we'll permit you to do research only on the 60 cell lines where the question of life and death has already been decided. That's not likely to be a very workable conclusion, but it's a political one, even though he insists this was not a political decision. Who are we kidding? So, where should the moral fiber for society come from? It won't come from the scientists, because science can't generate morals. It can tell you the implications of certain kinds of moral practice, but it can't really generate them. This is why it is of great concern to me that religious organizations get more actively involved in this entire discussion and debate. But they cannot do it by sitting in ivory towers and just pontificating. That goes nowhere. The Pope has learned that over the years, and so he now, you know, they put out formal encyclicals. His recent one on faith and reason, I think, is an absolute masterpiece. But the Pope does have a background in philosophy, so he understands a lot of the problems. And he doesn't argue, as we're prone to do in the church, that material gained through faith and information gained through faith is superior to anything gained through reason. He takes really a much more balanced approach and even goes so far as to say it is reason that keeps faith from becoming superstition. Now, religions can do three things, it seems to me, with science. You can either ignore it, which is what many of our people do. You can either combat it, which is what young earth creationists do. Or you can engage it and hope for a meaningful synthesis of the interests from a variety of perspectives. But you can engage in that synthesis only if you have built a background where you can do that. In all honesty, and it is a source of deep pain to me, we in Mormonism do not have that foundation built where we can meaningfully contribute. Classic case was in the recent case of cloning, where we had the National Bioethics Advisory Committee collect information from all the religions in America. This was native religions, it was Islam, it was Buddhism, it was, you know, varieties of Christianity. And we as a church had nothing to say. And even though the head of the committee was an LDS person, the publication is out with all those inputs and there is nothing whatever from Mormonism. We are, in that sense, irrelevant to the national discussion. And I think that means we've got some work to do. I'm sorry that was too long an answer. And it wasn't an answer.
My question was, how do we get away from this ivory tower suppression? In 36 at Rick's, we were studying organic evolution in our geology glasses. We were far enough away from the micromanagement of Salt Lake that that was possible. I'm wondering, I was once on the Mormon-El, if our Mormon-El and our websites wouldn't be the way that we can disseminate information and attitudes to these young people that you mentioned and who are desperate to try to find some solution between their religion and science?
Excellent question. There are many websites available. I am not a very expert person on the internet, so I can't tell you about very many. Iring L has certainly been, you know, the granddaddy, I think, of discussions between of science and Mormonism on the internet. There are a good many others. As with all other things on the internet, you find a lot of assertions being made that are not in any way hampered by any knowledge of the subject. So one has to sort through that as well. We have tried two or three times to put together organizations of LDS scientists to try to deal with things, but or to try to help with some of these issues. But interest fairly quickly flags because there's this feeling of always having to swim upstream in terms of dealing with these issues in the church. I wish I had a good answer. I just don't. I think that books such as Jeff and Trent have put out are going to be a critical start, and but I don't know if they'll be enough to turn the current at all. The last 50 years, Mormonism has taken a real stance toward anti-intellectualism, anti-science, and there has been a very real shift since 1954, and that's been, I think, not to our detriment. I mean, to our detriment. Yes.
You've mentioned the bias of the curriculum writers for the Sunday School Relief Society Priesthood Manuals under Joseph F. Smith. It seems to me this is rather biasly persuasive in the seminaries and to some extent the institute programs of the church, which are influencing so much of our young people's thought. I know the seminary student manuals and the teacher curriculum are clearly have a bias against organic evolution, even though we have a number of neutrality statements of no position. It seemed to me that that as a science department at BYU, you would help yourself if you'd write up there, write a letter and say, let us at least have neutrality.
There are some institutional problems with BYU faculty putting a letter to the brethren. that has to go by institutional expectations, go through all the channels between us and the brethren. And sometimes those channels have worked well, and sometimes those have not worked well. Our administrators are burdened with a great many other issues as well, raising money and dress codes and, you know, other critical things. And sometimes, for various reasons, their agendas don't seem to find time for these sort of issues. I have been heartened by... I teach a course also in history and philosophy of biology, and we do a good deal with LDS history and doctrine in that as well. And I've had two students now who've been training to be seminary teachers, both of whom have told me that in their classes it has been drilled into them that you do not use the scriptures as a doctrinal battering ram to try to recruit students to your own particular view of the gospel. That you should introduce the scriptures as a place where individuals can go to try to find answers to their personal questions. I don't know that has become persuasive yet in the system. We do continually hear of seminary and institute teachers, mostly seminary teachers, who have given answers much as Keith has indicated his son got. The Old Testament manual, for instance, does quote Seventh-day Adventist scientists. It quotes creationist scientists as though this is good, solid science and compatible with Mormon doctrine. There are those problems there, and I'm just not sure how to impact those. There are people who are trying. We'll leave it there. Others? Keith? Yes.
This will have to be the last one.
This is kind of a follow-up on the last question. I'm a retired high school biology teacher, and when I started in the 50s, I got a little bit of flack from the seminary teachers on evolution, but not much. And I thought that by the time I retired, that we would have won the battle war or whatever. Just the opposite was the case. As this last gentleman said, in the 70s and 80s, I retired in 88, when we were teaching evolution in biology, why, that's when the seminary teachers would start attacking us, and it was a big disappointment. And that's been one of the biggest disappointments of my career, that we haven't won the battle in the minds of the members of the church, not even the bright students. It's gone the other way,
in my opinion.
That has been there. I do know of schools where there is a regular animosity between seminary and science teachers. Others seem to work very, very well. I know of some places where the science teachers have just gone over and sat down with the seminary people and have said, look, let's work together on this. You know, I happen to be your bishop and you're my first counselor. Let's see if we can't come to some meeting of the minds on this. And sometimes that has worked well, and sometimes that hasn't. I would like to say one thing about seminaries, however. Those brethren and sisters are very, very dedicated people, and I think we can thank them for the fact that we have not had in Utah any of the waves of creationism to be put into the public schools that other states have had. You know, those states and legislatures have been torn apart. Hawaii just got it resolved just a week ago last night from their fight, and it's been in North Dakota and Kansas and Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin and states all over the country. We've had none of it here. No suggestion that we put creationism into the science classrooms. It doesn't belong there. It's not science. It can perhaps be in social science classrooms. It'd be all right. But certainly not in the science classrooms. And I think the reason that we've not had the pressure here is because our people feel that, well, the seminary system can take care of our children's spiritual concerns. We don't have to be messing around with the philosophies of the public schools. Now, that can be seen both good and bad, but I think it has reduced the level of division in our communities here in Utah that could have developed otherwise. And I think seminaries need to be given an appreciation. Maybe it's backhanded. They've done some good things, some bad things. It's mixed as well. But all institutions, including science, do good things and bad things.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jeffrey.